warm welcome to Animal Voices. My name's Alyssa. You are listening to Co-op Radio, broadcasting live from the downtown east side on unceded Coast Salish territories on 100.5 FM CFRO. I am joined in studio today by Allison on the controls. Hi there. And Mavidat.
Hello. Nice to be here.
He's our guest today. Very happy that you could be with us.
And I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
So today we have two very special interviews. First off, we're going to start with, Allison's going to fill us in on some New York vegan highlights just for a few minutes at the beginning. And then we jump into our first interview. It's with Dr. Armady May. She's a vegan, an animal activist, a veterinarian. She's talking about how and why and if cats and dogs can be vegan. And so, yeah, Jackie talked to her earlier this week. We're excited to hear from her today, and we'll be starting with that very shortly. And then later in the show, what do we have, Mavidat?
We're going to be interviewing We're going to be interviewing Lisa Hutchinson from the Small Animal Rescue Society here in Vancouver. And they're a rescue society that helps rabbits, hamsters, guinea pigs, and other small animals.
So it's a companion animal show, and I think it's Lisa Hutchin.
Sorry, yes.
Yeah. And that will be in the second half of the show. Excited. Thanks for joining us today.
So just before I start, Alyssa, I'm going to need your help in here while I'm doing this segment.
Sure.
That's what we talked about. So I just got back from New York City. I was just chatting with you two about that a little bit, and I wanted to give you my top five picks for New York City. And that would be vegan places to eat. So the first place that I wanted to, actually number five, so we stayed in Brooklyn, and the, have you ever heard of Champ's Bakery, Mav?
I haven't, actually.
Okay,
so these are all in Brooklyn, the ones that you visited.
Yeah, no, just this one.
So
we actually stayed in Brooklyn, and there's this wonderful place called Champ's Junior. So that's my pick for number five. And it was just actually a mere one block away from where we were staying, and I really wanted to go there like every day for breakfast because it was open really early. It was so close, but we didn't actually get to that because we were just, there was just so much food. So Champ's Junior is actually an offshoot diner style restaurant. It's just a sister, or you could say a daughter or son restaurant to the well-known Champ's Bakery, which is also in Brooklyn, and this one opened last fall. It's a really small space, but it has an abundant and a delectable menu of all kinds of vegan comfort food. And I had the breakfast burrito, which was a generously sized burrito filled with field roast, chorizo sausage, tofu scramble, bell peppers, vegan cheese, home fries, and chipotle dressing, and a whole wheat tortilla. Alyssa, you would have loved it. This is your kind of food. It's like comfort food. It was just really, really tasty. And they had a huge variety, but we really only went there for breakfast.
So they have breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
Yeah. They're actually open from 7 a.m. till 11 p.m., I think, every day. So as are most places in New York, places are open really, really late. So this small diner is located at 620 Manhattan Avenue in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Number four, Peace Food Cafe. So I've been hearing great reviews recently about Peace Food Cafe. It's one of those must-go-to vegan restaurants in New York City, and I am so glad that we made it there. They actually have two locations in Manhattan, and I wasn't that hungry when we went there, so I got a healthy kale salad, and it was a very decent kale salad. It was filled with tofu, tempeh bacon, pumpkin seeds, and raisins. But what I'm really giving this place a spot on my top five list for is for the desserts. Not only were they so delicious, but they were really well priced as well. I'm used to paying like anywhere from $9 to $12 for a vegan dessert at a vegan restaurant. It seems like that's the going price these days. These ones ranged from the ones that we had from $6.25 to $7.50 each. There were three of us there. My sister and I went with a friend, and We shared a peanut butter cheesecake, a tiramisu, which was such a generous serving. I was so impressed. And a strawberry shortcake, which just had the most flaky pastry to it. And it was so delicious. And they also have a really good variety of dishes. They have raw, they have salad, sandwiches, pizzas, plus other dishes such as a penne unchicken parmesan. So I definitely want to get back there for sure. And yeah, that they've got two locations in the downtown and uptown areas. My number three, Candle Cafe West. Have you heard of Candle 79, known to be basically one of the best fine dining locations in to eat in North America?
No, I haven't heard of that either.
Yeah, so Candle Cafe West, it's a sister location as well. They actually have a few locations. The ambience is very classy, very high prices to match, but the food was so delicious. I had this grilled artichoke appetizer to start, which was totally to die for, and a Cajun Satan sandwich. The appetizer was $16, so was the sandwich. So the prices aren't cheap, like I said, but that's definitely my number three. So number two, the Cinnamon Snail. This is one of my favorite food places of all time, and I love the whole concept of it. It's a food truck. It roams the city of New York, so you can find it all around throughout the week, and it's been rated the number one place to eat in New York City by Yelp this year, and the number four place in all of America.
Oh yeah, I've definitely heard of that one.
Yeah, so delicious.
Are you talking about vegan places or all places?
These are all places, Yelp, wow. I believe. Yeah, as far as I know. As far as I know, that's what it said on their site. So they have really, really hearty sandwiches, such as a lemongrass five-spice seitan sandwich with curried cashews, arugula, Sichuan chili sauce, and wasabi mayonnaise on a grilled baguette. Also, Alyssa, I know you would really like this place. That's $9. Totally worth the $9. It's huge. It's messy. It's chewy. And you're getting a lot for your $9. So if you want to know where they'll be at any on any given day, you can check out their Facebook page. And finally, for number one, very quickly, Blossom. So also on par with the Candle restaurants, Blossom's family of restaurants are known to offer some of the best and fanciest vegan food on the continent. We went there last time. I just had to go again. It sort of has like, I would say definitely an Italian flair, very fancy. I started off with the roasted pumpkin and sweet potato gnocchi with sauteed kale, golden beets, and a sage cashew cream for $12. And for my main, I actually got the same thing that I had last time, which was it was a pizza margarita, grilled flatbread, plum tomato ragu, mozzarella cheese, which is Dea. It was really good. And for dessert, another to die for, tiramisu. That's located in the West Village. That was Blossom on Carmine. They do have a few locations, plus the Blossom du Jour takeout places. So those are my top five food picks for New York City in a brief 5 minutes for this time around.
Very nice.
So now, can and should dogs and cats be vegan? It's a question that comes up very often. People who are newly transitioning to being vegan or have been vegan for a long time ask themselves that question and sometimes wrestle with it and struggle with it. There's a lot of different opinions out there. So we decided to check in with a doctor of veterinary medicine, Dr. Armady May. She's a dog and cat veterinarian currently practicing in the West Los Angeles area. As an undergraduate student in UC Berkeley, she became a vegan and animal activist. And she's made done a lot of amazing things in her life to help animals. And Jackie checked in with her earlier this week to ask her our most pressing questions.
Hello, Dr. Armady May, and thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So I'll start by asking, just related to a common debate which seems to come up amongst vegans and non-vegans, which is whether or not their companion animals can be vegan. Can you start by telling me what some common misconceptions there are about dogs and cats in reference to transitioning them to a vegan diet?
Definitely. Well, dogs are actually omnivores, so they can adapt quite well to a plant-based diet. In fact, their ancestors, the wolves, have a distinct lineage that has changed over the years to allow dogs to have a greater ability to digest carbohydrates. So they're distinct from wolves in that aspect. And in some cases, dogs can actually do even better on a vegetarian or vegan diet than they would on a meat-based diet. But there are some modes of thought or schools of thought that promote the raw bones, which has certain drawbacks to it, of course, because that's what they would do in the wild. But, you know, our domesticated dogs have definitely separated from their historical ancestors in terms of what they're able to digest and how efficiently they can process plant foods. So we have to bear that in mind, plus the fact that commercial meat-based foods aren't the healthiest. They have slaughterhouse rejects, diseased body lesions from animals that are diseased and dying of cancer that are also unfit for human consumption. Not that you or I would eat that stuff because we're vegans, but certainly not the healthiest thing to be feeding our animal companions either. And also there are various other toxins that find their way into the conventional meat-based products, including mycotoxins, hormone and antibiotic residues, various potential for prion contaminants if there's any suspicion about mad cow disease, also known as bovine spongiform encephalopathy. And so those are real concerns that can have detrimental impacts on our companion animals, including degenerative diseases such as kidney disease, arthritis, cancers. And we've seen a dramatic increase in the incidence of cancers in our companion animals over the past few decades. So there's certainly reason to suspect that the commercially meat-based pet foods may have a role to play in that. And that's in combination with ethical concerns about supporting the slaughter industry has led people to feed alternative diets, including vegan diets. So I think for dogs, it's definitely very doable and actually can have health benefits, including for skin allergy problems that dogs can have. Now, with cats, on the other hand, it's a little more controversial because they are biologically carnivorous rather than omnivorous, but that doesn't mean that they cannot do well on a vegan diet as long as it meets their nutritional needs. And there are certain precautions that have to be taken with cats beyond that, which I can go into as well.
Sure. And you mentioned commercial meat diets, but I also notice, you know, the raw meat diets seem to be really trending with dogs and cats, and also are, of course, the associated health risks. Can you share what some of the biggest medical risks are of feeding a raw diet to your a raw meat diet to your dog or cat?
Sure. Well, one of the issues with raw food diets, since they are not cooked, there is more of a risk for bacterial and possibly parasitic infections to take hold both in the intestinal tract and through handling by humans preparing the food, because those are microscopic and we cannot tell if they're there or not without, you know, further testing that, you know, is beyond what we can notice with the naked eye. So if it's not handled properly, there can be cross-contamination in the kitchen. It can make people sick. It can also make the dog sick who are consuming these raw meat diets. Also, with the bones that sometimes are fed in these raw meat diets, those can cause gastrointestinal discomfort and, in the worst-case scenario, even perforations of the intestine.
Mm-hmm. And you were just starting to mention the fact that cats are obligate carnivores. What are some things to be aware of when switching a cat to a vegan diet?
Well, that's an excellent question. Cats are obligate carnivores, but in some cases they can be maintained successfully on a vegan diet. And certain things that have to be looked out for include their urinary tract health and their overall weight in terms of their intake of calories and overall health. So cats are well known for their finicky nature, especially some cats more than others. But, you know, they're cats that will just turn their noses up at certain foods and refuse to eat them. And the trouble with cats not eating goes beyond just, oh, well, you know, they haven't eaten well, and they might lose a little bit of weight. Because if they don't eat for even several days, they can actually go into something called hepatic lipidosis or fatty liver syndrome, which is pretty severe, and it can require extensive hospitalization, which is quite expensive and traumatic. So we don't want that to happen. And if a cat is reluctant to eat the vegan food, then there may be tricks that can be used, such as adding nutritional yeast, a little bit of oil, something to entice them into eating it, maybe mixing it very, very gradually with the the previous food, the non-vegan food. Those are different tricks that can be used to get them to go for that. But ultimately, you know, the cat's going to be the one to decide, because I would not advocate force feeding the cat the vegan food. If he or she refuses, then they pretty much have made up their mind. But it's certainly something that can be tried, and a lot of cats will take to it if it's done, you know, with patience and gradually transitioning them. One thing regarding the urinary tract that should be monitored is for the presence of crystals, especially in a male. That can be a big problem, because if they develop crystals, that can potentially block the urethra, which is the outflow where the urine comes out of. And if that is blocked, it's actually a life-threatening emergency. It's also known as feline or urinary tract disease. And a urinary blockage is an emergency requiring immediate veterinary intervention with catheterization, usually done under sedation or anesthesia. And then they need to be in the hospital for typically 24 to 48 hours just to help give them IV fluids, which flushes out their system and gets them back to a state of health. To avoid that, or prevent that from happening, I recommend getting the urine checked about 3 weeks after switching to the vegan diet. First, a baseline urinalysis should be obtained before switching, and then 3 weeks after having them on the vegan food, getting a urine sample check to compare that to the baseline. And if there are crystals, struvite crystals specifically, then there can be measures taken, vitamin C being one acidifier that can be used. There are other acidifiers that can be used to acidify the urine and bring it back to a normal pH for a cat. Cats normally are more acidic in their blood and urine pH since they are biologically carnivorous. And since plant-based food is more alkaline-forming, that can have an effect on the urine being more alkaline, which can lead to crystals. So that's why we want to monitor that and head off any problems before they occur.
And how can we prevent any complications?
Well, one thing is close monitoring, being observant of your cat's patterns with urination. The other thing I would strongly recommend is ensuring adequate water intake. And what you can do is add water to the kibble and soak it for about 10 to 15 minutes with warm water, so it creates kind of a gruel or soup consistency. That ensures that your cat is drinking plenty of water. Or feed a wet diet to begin with, canned diet. You can even add a little bit of water to the canned food to make it more soupy in consistency. The more moisture your cat is consuming, the more dilute the urine will be, and the less likely crystals will form.
Okay, and I know there's many diets, vegan diets, for dogs, but I haven't seen very many for cats. What foods would you feel comfortable recommending for a cat?
Well, yeah, there are a couple of brands that are out there for cats. There's Evolution, which is what I feed my cats, and I order it online. Also, there's a vegan grocery store near where I live, Viva La Vegan, that has it in stock on their shelves, and that's convenient. There's also OmniCat that's available online, but it's not available in a wet form, just a dry kibble. And so it just depends what your cat likes, and you have to, you know, keep in mind the development of crystals being a possible issue. So if the cat will not take the food that's the kibble soaked in water, then it may be better to at least switch it up with some canned food, or maybe just switch to a home-cooked recipe, which is also an option. There's a company called the Harbingers of a New Age. Their website is veggiepet.com. That's VEGEPET.com. And they offer supplement mixes that can be mixed into homemade vegan cat and dog food, including a pH-adjusted formula for cats that have predisposition to urinary crystals.
And you mentioned that your cats are vegan. How are they doing on the diet?
Well, they're doing fine. They like the food, and they're, you know, always willing to eat it. I'm lucky that way. They're not too picky, so you know, not all cats are that cooperative, but, you know, they've been on it for several years now, and, you know, they haven't had any issues, thankfully.
Great. And for people wanting to prepare home-cooked vegan meals for their dogs, what are some foods and vitamins that you would recommend people add to their food?
Well, I would recommend having some commercial vegan dog food to supplement any home-cooked regimen, just to make sure that any trace mineral deficiencies are covered, because it's challenging to have a totally balanced home-cooked diet unless you are, you know, very, very careful with covering all the different nutrients that they're going to need. If the dog has some kind of allergy to ingredients in the existing commercially available vegan dog foods, then there would be, you know, more reason to do that, in which case they can work one-on-one with a veterinarian and get the guidance required to make sure the diet is nutritionally sound. But if they want to do a small portion with the commercial diet and do some homemade food, that, you know, that would work out, and they can just do a legume such as garbanzo beans or lentils with vegetables and some oils too, like hemp oil or flax oil, and create a recipe that the dog enjoys. Like, to make a lentil stew with rice or millet or oats, and then make it tasty by, you know, adding a little nutritional yeast, maybe putting in some different vegetables like carrots and greens, beets. Those are, you know, really nutritious, and you want to aim for organic if available. So there are some websites that offer vegetarian recipes for dogs. There's vegetariandogs.com that has a recipe book you can order to make homemade vegan dog food. So those are some resources that people can get. And then there's a supplement available from petkelp.com. It's a kelp-based nutritional vitamin mineral supplement that can be used to supplement a homemade.
And what would you say to people that claim feeding your dog a vegan diet is forcing your beliefs on them?
Well, I've heard that claim before. I don't consider that to be the case, because we've domesticated dogs. Our ancestors domesticated them about 10,000 years ago. And there's a symbiotic relationship between dogs and humans, as there is between cats and humans, meaning that they rely on us, and, you know, to an extent we rely on them for companionship and company. So we're in this together, and since our ancestors have already domesticated them, they are reliant on us for care, nutrition, shelter, veterinary care. It's not something they would be receiving in the wild. If a dog is left to wander to the streets, well, in the United States, that dog would most likely end up in a shelter, and we all know that that's not always the best outcome for them. But if someone is rescuing a dog, they're taking that or cat into their home. They're basically agreeing to take care of that animal. So if I don't believe in contributing my hard-earned money towards monetarily supporting the slaughter of animals, then there's no reason why I should have to do that for my dog. If my dog can do well and be healthy and thrive on a vegan diet. So I don't see it as pushing my beliefs on another animal, when you consider the fact that they do rely on us for care, and we are providing that. It's not like we're starving them or we're depriving them of what their body needs. It's just a mental concept that we have. It's almost like anthropomorphizing to say that they really want to have this, and they're feeling deprived because they can't have it. I mean, my cats love their food. They purr when I open the can and scoop out the vegan food for them, and they just gobble it on down like it's the best thing ever. So they're not being deprived. As long as their health is being cared for, that's the important thing. And they're going to learn to enjoy it just like they had enjoyment for the other food. Their palates can change just like our palates, our taste buds actually change to where we crave different food. You know, once you start cleaning up your diet, eating fresh fruits and veggies, you actually enjoy that more than you would, say, you know, a candy bar, which is refined. It's not, you know, what we should be eating. So I think that argument doesn't really take into account the fact that we're taking care of these animals who are dependent on us, and we're being responsible towards meeting their needs, which includes their nutritional needs, but it, you know, it has to be done in a responsible way, of course.
And you mentioned with cats, but are there any potential concerns with feeding dogs a plant-based diet?
Well, there are certain breeds of dogs that can be prone to urinary struvite crystal formation, just like cats can be prone to urinary struvite crystal formation if the urine pH becomes too alkaline. And those breeds are miniature poodles, miniature schnauzers, cocker spaniels, Bichon frises, Lhasa apso's, and shih tzus. So if someone has one of those breeds, they definitely should monitor the urine closely. And again, like I said, for the cats, I would recommend getting a baseline urinalysis done. It's a simple test. You just go to your vet and ask to have a urinalysis done. And it's inexpensive. It gives a number of pieces of information, not only the pH of the urine, but also if there's bacteria present, if there are red blood cells present or white blood cells. In dogs, more so than in cats, if there are struvite crystals, sometimes it has to do with an infection. And so if that's something that can be treated with antibiotics and then rechecked, sometimes it's just a matter of getting the infection cleared. But these particular breeds are more prone to struvite crystals, which can then turn into stones if they aren't treated in time. And that, of course, is a big problem, which would require surgery in some cases, although there's some diets that can supposedly dissolve the crystals. But there are pros and cons to those. So you definitely want to prevent those if you can. Now, there are another group of dog breeds that also are prone to a different problem called dilated cardiomyopathy, which is a heart condition, and that can be associated with taurine and or carnitine deficiency. And since taurine is generally found in meat products, although it can be supplied synthetically, there can be concerns with vegan diets in certain breeds. And those breeds are Cocker Spaniels, Boxers, Afghan Hounds, Scottish Deerhounds, Irish Wolfhounds, St. Bernards, and Doberman Pinschers. So if someone has one of those dogs, I would either ensure that the dog food they're feeding has taurine added in it or consider supplementing their diet with taurine or carnitine. And there's a website they can go to, which is carnitine-taurine.com, which has the supplements they can order.
And I think it's also important to mention that, you know, the struvite crystals, both dogs and cats, can happen whether it's a vegan or a meat-based diet. Some animals, like you mentioned, are just more prone to it. Yeah.
And that is true.
Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I've unblocked a lot of cats who were not vegan. So the urinary blockage that I mentioned earlier can absolutely happen to non-vegan cats as well. Some people will really think that the lack of moisture in the diet is the principal cause of that problem. And certainly, you know, a lot of cats, not just vegan cats, are eating dry food, which is not the ideal.
And do you have any further comments or recommendations for anyone wanting to switch their companions to a vegan diet?
Well, I would suggest doing it gradually, allowing enough time for the animal's digestive tract to adjust to the new food. Being patient, sometimes the animal may just avoid the new food entirely and just gradually increase the proportion of the new food with the old food's amount being diminished over the course of 1 to 2 weeks. If that doesn't work, you can always try again with maybe a different formula or a different flavor, because cats, you know, can be particular about which flavors they like. You can also try mixing in a little bit of tuna juice or something else that's really appealing to the cat or dog of, you know, possible animal origin along with the vegan food, and then gradually diminish the amount of that that's added until they're eating it like they would a former food.
And how can people find out more or get in touch with you?
Well, I do offer phone and email consultations. They can email me through my website, which is veganvet.net, and I can talk with them about their specific situation. I am in the Los Angeles area, so without seeing their pet, it may be a little challenging to give specific advice, although, you know, I have also reviewed records from other veterinarians in other parts of the country in certain cases where people were more comfortable consulting with me in fear of their vet frowning upon what they were doing diet-wise. So, you know, it's something we can talk about, but the ideal is to have a good relationship with one's veterinarian to where one doesn't feel restricted or in fear of being reprimanded on account of the diet that's fed. So more and more vets are starting to become open-minded, and I would hope about certainly dogs being on a vegan diet, cats definitely less so, but I'm happy to share information with other vets as well if they're open to hearing about it. There's some videos of me giving talks on YouTube about vegan diets for dogs and cats, and I have articles that I've posted people can check out on the veganhealth.org website under companion animals, so people can read that for free. There's also a great resource by Dr. Andrew Knight that provides further information on vegan diets for dogs and cats, which can be accessed from vegepets.info. That's VEGEPETS.info. There's also another veterinarian, Dr. Laura Lee Wakefield, who did a study on cats and vegan diets for cats, and her website is vegetariancats.com.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Marty May, for joining me today for this interview.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
You are listening to 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's Co-op Radio, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories. And we'll be with you soon for the news.
Just on the point of the differences among cats and outside.
Vancouver Co-op Radio CFRO is live and local, and we're having an open house at our new location, 2014 Wall Street. Join us in celebrating our station relocation on Sunday, July 6th from 1 to 5 p.m. The event includes a barbecue, raffle, speakers, live DJs, and a tour of our new studios. You can also tune in to 100.5 FM for special programming focused around our move and our new neighborhood. Live and local, Co-op Radio Wall Street Open House, Sunday, July 6th at 2014 Wall Street in Vancouver. For more information, visit co-opradio.org or call us at 604-684-7561.
Now for some quick news items. So Esther the Wonder Pig, have you heard of her?
Yes, I have, of course.
Absolutely. Good news today. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
So for those who don't know, you can check out EstherTheWonderPig.com to see some pictures. The story is 2 years ago, she came home as a mini pig, and her guardians discovered that she was not a mini pig at all, but was bred for commercial consumption. And she now is happily still living with her guardians. She's over 500 pounds. Her spirit and charm have won over her guardians, who went vegan subsequently after meeting her and taking her into their hearts and lives. And now Esther has won over thousands through social network and media. The news today is that Esther's guardians have raised over $405,000 to put towards the new sanctuary they're starting, which is 45 minutes out of Toronto. So it'll be Canada's newest sanctuary. And over 6,800 individual funders helped make that happen. You can check out our interview with Esther's guardians on Animal Voices, January 3rd, 2014. That's animalvoices.org. Check that out. And then just quickly, wanted to mention there was a steer in California named Panda, a black and white steer, that recently survived being set on fire by someone who broke into a building and poured flammable liquid on the steer and set him on fire. The suspect was arrested. Now, the sad twist is that future Farmers of America student, who was her guardian, said that even though he's gotten considerable offers from animal advocates who want to save Panda, he will be sent for slaughter as expected. It shows his dedication to farming and very insensitive and sad report there. I saw in the news today that Leonardo DiCaprio has pledged $7 million towards ocean conservation projects over the next 2 years. And previously to this, he's donated $3 million to Oceana, a nonprofit ocean conservation society. So $10 million going towards the oceans. That's pretty remarkable. That's pretty much it for the news today. And on to our feature interview.
Yes. So I am interviewing Lisa Hutchin of the Small Animal Rescue Society of British Columbia. And do we have her on the line, Allison?
We do.
Oh, great. So Lisa Hutchin is the director for Small Animal Rescue, which is a volunteer-run animal rescue society that is a virtual rescue. So they don't actually have a specific location that they are holding these animals, but they have volunteers that provide them their forever homes. And I think that we'll hear more about that from Lisa, who is, I believe, on the line with us.
Hi.
Hi, Lisa. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. You?
Good. I'm sorry for calling you Hutchinson earlier.
Oh, no worries.
So, can you tell us a little bit about the Small Animal Rescue Society?
Sure. Actually, this year is our 10th anniversary. We started back in 2004. And we started out as a group of volunteers at a local shelter, actually walking dogs. And over time, we just noticed that the small animals sort of always fell by the wayside and started to decide to see if there's anything we could do to help them. And we eventually established a foster program, and then that grew and grew and grew over time. And we needed a way to support it and pay for things and vet care and food, things like that. So we decided to form a registered charity and have been going since then.
Wow, that's great. So if there are these domestic and wildlife animal rescues, why is it necessary to have a small animal rescue specifically?
Well, the thing is, most shelters started out as animal control, and then they developed into municipal shelters or SPCAs, and a lot of them were developed just to handle cats and dogs, or staff to handle cats and dogs, and people expect to just go there and find cats and dogs. But then with small animals, the traditional ways of finding homes for them through the paper and things like that weren't helping, and they were coming to shelters, but they were coming to shelters and the shelters couldn't house them. They didn't know how to care for them. They'd come in too many at once, so it was just sort of a way for us to be able to help out, is to establish something specific for small animals where you have volunteers that know how to, you know, care for them. We have specialized vets that can help treat them, and we're able to place them into homes that are knowledgeable, and we can support the homes that way as well.
That makes a lot of sense. So given the animals that I have seen at the rescue, it seems SARS is primarily dedicated to finding homes for rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, and other domestic rodents.
Right.
Are there other animals that typically qualify as small animals for SARS's mission?
Well, we do sometimes branch out. You know, we may help the occasional bird, but that's only if we have a volunteer that's bird savvy. There are other bird rescues like Grey Haven. There's a reptile rescue in Richmond that deals with reptiles. So we don't want to take on a bunch of different types of animals that we're not comfortable with and we aren't sure of what their needs are. So we're sort of sticking to what our specialty is. And, that way the animals that we bring in, we know we can home properly. We know we can care for properly. And it just, things can get out of hand too quick with small animals. And as well, wildlife, it's illegal to house or rehab wildlife unless you're a wildlife rehabber. And there's so many cat and dog rescues, why reinvent the wheel and why duplicate efforts? So we're trying to focus, on a specialized area and stay within that.
Specialized small animal rescue. Yeah, that makes sense. So why are there so many small animals that need rescuing in this category?
The thing is with small animals, traditionally they're thought of starter pets for kids. You know, parents want to get a hamster or guinea pig for their pet or their child before they get a real pet, a cat or a dog. But the thing is with small animals, a lot of them will live as long as a cat or dog. Chinchillas can live 20 years. Rabbits can live 12 to 14 years, and the commitment isn't there. Usually when a pet is bought for a child, they lose interest after the first month or so, so then the burden flips onto the parent, and then the parent, you know, decides, oh, I'm going to look for a new home for this animal. So there's just, people are getting all these animals, and they get them specifically because their child wants them. They're not doing it with a lot of research. They're not doing it with a commitment that it's a family pet, and they're not, you know, looking into the types of animals that they're getting. So there's a lot of sort of matched expectations, and once they get the small animal, a lot of them are just considered disposable because they're either cheap or they're small or their lifespans, you know, for hamsters aren't that long, so they're kind of considered disposable in our society, is that?
Yeah, I think a lot of people underestimate the lifespan of a lot of these animals.
Yeah.
So in the founding history of SARS that you have on your website, you describe how your shelter colleagues expressed annoyance at your insistence on ensuring that no more small animals were hastily euthanized. It's a very moving story, and I would encourage everybody to go read it. But do you ever feel frustrated at this lack of wider compassion for small animals among domesticated animal sympathizers?
I'm frustrated every day. I'm frustrated 24/7 hours a day. It's sad, you know, it's changing because we've been around now 10 years and we're helping to, you know, educate our colleagues with regards to small animals, their needs. And a lot of the fellow rescuers who do cats and dogs really have no clue about small animals, and they didn't know their plight, they didn't know their suffering, they didn't know their needs, they didn't know, you know, the demand on us, but now they're starting to see that. But it's really frustrating because people are still cat and dog focused, and to be honest, you know, they don't care about small animals. One horrifying story was on a rescue message board, one of the rescuers that works with dogs was asking how to kind of humanely dispatch their own hamster at home versus taking to a vet. You know, small animals, a lot of people don't want to spend the money on vet care. So even within the traditional rescue community, there's still a lot of discrimination against small animals, and it's frustrating really bad. And within the shelter environment, too, you know, a lot of staff, they're there because they love cats and dogs, but they'll tell you that they hate small animals or they hate rats or they don't like rabbits or, you know, so it's frustrating, especially even when it's internal.
I can imagine. And following up on that, a two-part question, to what extent do you feel that this pervasive apathy and disdain for rodents also finds expression in the behavior and attitudes of vegans or animal rights activists? And then also, is it legitimate for us to call this a kind of orderism, since rodents and mammals are of the order Rodentia, in comparison or similar to the term speciesism to signify species-based exclusion?
Well, I think it's frustrating because, you know, when people think of animals rescue, again, they think of cats or dogs, but you know, it's changing, and within the vegan community or the vegetarian, you know, support group or supporters, that sort of thing, they don't think of small animals, and it's changing because, you know, people are starting to think of all animals have feelings, no matter how small. All animals are worthy. All animals deserve to be rescued. All animals deserve to be protected, and especially if we've domesticated them. So that's changing, but again, it's, you know, people are brought up rodents are dirty, rabbits are stinky, you know, rabbits are food, they should be kept outside, and that's a sad thing that we're still struggling with is people's ideas that you get an animal, a family pet, and you stick it out in the backyard in a hutch or out in a garage, and people aren't realizing that, but it is changing, I think, within, you know, sort of the vegan movement, and people there are starting to realize that they're feeling animals, you know, they're intelligent, they deserve as much respect and protection from everybody.
Yeah, I wonder if people would be more respectful of rodents if they knew that we all evolved from rodents after the extinction, the mass extinction of dinosaurs. It was actually the ability of rodents to scavenge and survive that that meteorite strike that allowed us to be here today.
Well, I think it's just sad because a lot of people look at the animal and what they've been told as they grow up, but they don't get the chance to sort of get to know them. Once they get to know this little hamster or this little rat, and they see that they have individual personalities, mm-hmm. and they're intelligent, and they're social, and they're empathetic towards each other, you know, their feelings start to change, but people just don't either get the chance to experience that, or they sort of don't open themselves up to that. It's really sad because they're such great little critters. But again, we're not advocating at all that people take in small animals and make them pets. It's already out there. It's a problem. There's a lot of homeless ones. So that's why we exist, is because, you know, somebody has to deal with all these animals that are just considered disposable.
I also found that until I lived in northeastern India, where dogs and cats lived entirely among and outside the city's trash heaps, mm-hmm. I couldn't understand why my Persian father would say dogs and cats were filthy. And yeah. It seems like you're identifying a similar feeling among North Americans that have inherited this cultural bias against rodents. Do you think that's the case, that because of our sort of cultural background, we have this bias towards rodents?
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of the research and stuff now is showing that the plague wasn't started by rats. I can't recall exactly what it was about, but, you know, they're not dirty animals. Rats are extremely clean. But again, people don't experience it for themselves. They're just going by what they're told. And then when you think of domestic rats and wild rats, it's a whole different ballgame. But again, they're not the disease carriers people make them out to be. So it's sort of unfair to kind of just discount them without knowing more about them. And that's why it just continues. You know, they continue to suffer and they continue to be dumped and things like that because people just aren't taking the time to sort of get to know them, know about them, and change their attitudes.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, the Black Plague was a confluence of three separate diseases that worked in synchronicity to be especially devastating. And I think only one aspect of it was related to rats.
Right.
So, finally, what considerations should someone who wanted to adopt a small animal take before providing that small animal their forever home?
Well, first of all, resist the impulse of the cute, furry little face and perhaps their child begging for a pet. Make sure that it's a family decision. Everybody's on board. Parents are on board. It's not going to be up to the 8-year-old to make sure the animal's fed and watered every day. It's a family thing. Do research on their needs. Make sure you have the money and are actually willing to spend money on proper vet care. Small animals require specialized vet care, and not all vets are small animal savvy, things like that. Also know the lifespan, know the needs, and you know, there's a lot of agencies, like if you're looking at a reptile, there's reptile rescue, bird rescue, small animal rescue. Talk to the rescue people, find out what they're like. See if you can foster an animal. See if that's a proper match. It may not be what you expected. And then if you're fostering, if it's not what you sort of expect an animal to be, there's always the option of them coming back and not contributing to overpopulation by buying one and then dumping it.
Well, that's great. Actually, it seems like we do have time for one more question.
Sure.
The University of Chicago researchers, as you alluded to, found that rats displayed a highly developed sense of empathy, preferring not only to help a cage mate in distress above the option of eating a piece of chocolate, but that they would actually release their cage mates so that they could share their chocolate together.
Yeah.
Do you think that we have something to learn from the sociability of rats and other rodents? And what is your take on the ethics of these non-invasive experiments on trapped rodents? You don't have to answer the second part, maybe just the first part.
Well, I think with all these little guys, you know, people, again, they just sort of see them as something to entertain their child or as a something rather than a someone. And they don't get to know them. They don't spend the time. They don't get to see how empathetic they can be towards each other, because a lot of times they'll just buy one rat, whereas rats are social animals, and they should be, you know, at least paired at a minimum. Rabbits, same thing. You know, once you sort of understand the animal and house them properly and house them with other, you know, animals of their species, then you get to see what they're really all about. And I think, you know, even though they're so small, people can learn a lot from these little guys, and not just sort of see them as, again, just a product or something. They see them as a living, socialized, interactive being with each other. And to see small animals being able to be empathetic or caring towards one another, you know, that's something you don't get to see all the time, and it's pretty special. So,
yeah, I just find rats just amazing, and watching the video for that study was it actually brought tears to my eyes to see the rats
and it
helping
me
one another.
That, you know, people just dismiss it. Like, you can bring that up or try to, you know, inform people about it, and they're just like, ah, get out of here, it's just a rat, don't be stupid. And that's sort of the attitude that we get. And that's one of the things that we struggle with, is just trying to change people's attitudes towards small animals.
You know, I think one thing that can change your attitudes is the power of social media. I saw the cutest video of a rat this morning, domesticated, eating spaghetti.
Oh, yeah.
They call him Ratatouille. Maybe you saw it. It's on Facebook. Such a sweet little creature, and it just really it really brings me to appreciate rats more.
Yeah, no, they're great. And that's the thing is, you know, if people research them, talk with rescues and things like that, make sure it's the right match, then you get to spend the quality time with them. You don't just buy it from the pet store, you know, and it's another object that goes in your kid's room and gets forgotten about. So, you know, people can have that opportunity to see how, you know, what wonderful animals they are.
I wanted to thank you, Lisa, for joining us. I just met some rats the other day, my first rats really I've met, and there was four in a cage, and they had so many toys and things to play with and little hammocks, and I just thought that's the way it should be, and it was interesting, the person who has them, who rescued them, they're rescued rats, said that they're not really interested in her after she got four of them, like they have their own thing going on, but she also said that she doesn't think animals have bodily autonomy, and she was kind of picking them up whenever she wanted. It was very strange, but anyway, it was happy to see them how they should be, just hanging out in their hammocks, and playing with
they
stuff.
They should all have hammocks.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's not really true about them, you know, people saying, oh, if I get two, then they won't be interested in me. You know, again, there's all these little rumors. Obviously, each individual is going to be, you know, have their own personality, but there's a lot of rumors and old school knowledge that is just not right anymore, so that's what's frustrating as well.
Thank you so much, Lisa Hutchin from the Small Animal Rescue Society.
Great, thank you.
I hope to have you guys on again, and maybe some volunteers, we can talk about some other issues.
That'd be great, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver's co-op radio, broadcasting live from unceded Coast Salish territories. Just quickly before we wrap up here, I have some events coming up for you. So first of all, this weekend, well, today's Friday, June 27th. And this weekend, Direct Action Everywhere is on their tour of the West Coast. And there will be events Monday, June 30th in the evening, and July 1st. They'll be doing some actions. If you want to learn more about their campaign, it's not food, it's violence, check out directactioneverywhere.com and maybe get in touch with them to ask how you can get involved around the West Coast. And also coming up this weekend, or next week, early next week, Victoria Vegan Fest. It's right downtown Victoria in Market Square. It's totally free. It is July 1st from 12 until 5 p.m. And Animal Voices will have a table there. Allison, Cynthia, and I, Alyssa, will be there to talk to people. We're really excited.
Come say hi.
Come say hi, please. And coming up in July, another thing this weekend. Saturday, June 28th, is Vegan Pizza Day. There's a couple events going on about that, or at least just support your local vegan pizza place. And in July, you want to mark your calendar for July 26th. That's a Saturday. It's a little ways away, but I want to give a heads up. VegFest Vancouver, which is downtown Vancouver on Granville Street, will happen on the day of July 26th. And then that evening, Cowspiracy, The Sustainability Secret, is playing for free at the Downtown Public Library. That's a brand new movie about how devastating livestock agriculture is to our environment, something that most environmentalists don't talk about or consider. And
there is also an event on Thursday, July 17th, on Harmless Fun, the meetup group that was recently created by Carissa Thorpe. It's called Animal Wisdom, Learning from the Spiritual Lives of Animals, and it's a talk given at Banyan Books. You can check out more about that on the meetup.com site.
Harmless Fun meetup, and Carissa Thorpe is a former Animal Voices host. Yay. So, of course, thanks for listening, and keep in touch. Animalvoices.org is where you'll find all our past shows, videos, and our blog, where we keep you informed. And there's links and everything in all our interviews and lots there. So do check out animalvoices.org. We'd love to hear your feedback. You can email us, radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. Is there something you'd like to hear on the show upcoming, or something you'd like to hear more of or less of? We really want to be in touch with you. We love our listeners, so please get in touch. Animal Voices Vancouver on Facebook. Make sure to like us and get notifications. It's so hard for nonprofits to get the word out these days, so make sure to get those notifications. Animal Voices YVR is where we tweet, and we'll let you know about upcoming shows and past shows when they're edited and posted on our website. Stay tuned to Co-op Radio to hear Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith, an excellent program. Remember to be kind to all animals. We're going to leave you with a song called Second Chance, and I don't know who it's by.
Stephen Gelman.
Awesome. So yeah, enjoy the tune, and we'll see you next week.
Second chance, you're giving me a second chance. And I can feel the wind beneath my wings once again. And when no one else would care, or the others, they just stared. You took me in and you gave me a second chance. You see, once I soared high above the trees late at night, with only the moonlight to guide my way. Oh, but something went wrong and I was no longer strong. It looked like I was earthbound to stay. And I was covered in dry mud, I was weak, I was confused. I guess you could see I was quite a mess. And I had lost the sight from one of my eyes. Tell the truth, I feared for my life. But second chance, oh, you're giving me a second chance. And I can feel the wind beneath my wings once again. When no one else would care, or the others, they just stare. You took me in and you gave me a second chance. Door. You reached out with loving hands and heart. And by the time the spring came, I'd regained all my strength. So you released me back into the night. And this is my thank you for all that you did, and all that you give of yourself. To my sisters and my brothers of the night and of the wild, those whose lives you touch every day. We need a second chance, we all need a second chance, to feel the wind beneath our wings once again. So whether you're an owl or a bear, maybe a human or a deer, second chance. Sometimes all we really need is that second chance.